here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us. Today is Friday, March 20th. I'm Emily Blake.
And I'm Rohith Joseph. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:03 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent, campus, local, and international news. Our first segment is a series of interviews by Moira Warburton, who explored the issues of the boycott, divest, and sanction movement launched against Israel corporations. Moira spoke to members of the Jewish Students Association, Hillel at UBC, the Social Justice Club, and Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights.
We also have a piece by myself, Rohit Joseph, who spoke with Jordan Bateman and Gordon Price about the transit referendum and the polarized views on tax-based funding of public transportation.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, rapid response leads to assault-related arrest on campus. RCMP and campus security apprehended a suspect in an incident near Totem Park residence before 1 a.m. on March 18th. The suspect was arrested and faces charges of attempted sexual assault and assault of a police officer. In this case, the timely interventions of the UBC campus community and all of those who proactively intervened to help led to a safe outcome. RCMP have confirmed this incident is unrelated to the 2013 sexual assaults at UBC or the recent assault on the South Campus in February. UBC RCMP are investigating the assault and will provide more information as soon as possible. Anyone who may have any information related to this incident should call RCMP or Crime Stoppers. This incident serves as a timely reminder of the importance of taking safety precautions. As a safety tip, use AMS SafeWalk, TransLink shuttles, or campus security services on campus. Call 911 immediately if you're feeling in danger or witnessing suspicious activity.
In local news, Vancouver Board of Education spending to be reviewed by advisor. The BC government is bringing in a third-party independent advisor to help the Vancouver School Board deal with the challenge of cutting about $15 million in spending to balance its budget. Education Minister Peter Fassbender on Thursday announced the plan for the province's second-largest school district, which is struggling with the budget shortfall. Mr. Fassbender noted new board members were elected last November. He said, quote, "It is a new board, there is a new board chair, and I want to do everything I can, and the government does, to be supportive in helping them move forward." Mr. Fassbender said the advisor will be recruited through a standard procurement process, and the government will not be taking anything from any school activities or classroom activities. Christopher Richardson, elected to the board last November and now the chair, said news of the provincial action was a surprise. Mr. Richardson said the board is facing, quote, "a substantial shortfall," but is confident staff will meet the deadline to come up with options for dealing with it. Asked why other boards facing similar challenges are not receiving similar attention, Mr. Fassbender said Vancouver stands out because it has been forthright with the ministry about its issues. Education critic for the opposition New Democrats, Rob Fleming, said Mr. Fassbender was trying to change the channel by drawing attention away from other issues and concerns. Anecdotal comments have been noted and discussed on social media, but nothing concrete. Mr. Richardson said the board will cooperate with the ministry-appointed operative and hope to seek positive suggestions.
In national news, suspended MP will not seek re-election. Newfoundland MP Scott Andrews has decided not to seek re-election in the Liberal caucus. Andrews was suspended from the Liberal caucus last November amidst allegations of sexual misconduct. These alleged actions include sexual harassment and sex without explicit consent. Liberal leader Justin Trudeau has since commissioned an independent investigation into these allegations from Toronto lawyer and human rights specialist Cynthia Peterson. Peterson turned in the results and summary of her investigation last week. Andrews is unable to release the executive summary of the investigation, but has refused to deny any wrongdoing on his part. Scott Andrews said that he accepts the findings and has chose to step down from his political partisanship. Following these recent events, Trudeau has stated that he considers the matter closed.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. Up next, we have Moira Warburton's interviews on the boycott, divest, and sanction movement, which is being put to referendum at UBC.
BDS stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanction. It is a movement that is Palestinian in origin to fight against the Israeli state's occupation of Palestine, and calls for a boycott of companies operating in Israel, in the West Bank, and in Gaza. It has come to a referendum question at UBC, and will be worded something like this. Do you support your AMS in boycotting companies which support the ongoing occupation of Palestine and war crimes perpetrated against the Palestinian people? Every part of this movement is controversial and contested. Who it's supported by? Are Palestinians really behind it? Who it's directed against? Israelis or the Israeli state? What its aims are? Freedom for Palestinians or destruction of the State of Israel? In producing this piece, I wanted to give both sides an equal platform to state their cases, both for and against the referendum. To do so, I talked to four current UBC students, two on each side of the issue. I asked all four the same questions, and through this was able to see where their opinions intersected and where they differed. Even within the same sides, there are so many nuances and complexities to this issue that are so easily lost. So without further ado, first up is Hossein Khan, an arts undergrad and spokesperson for the Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights Club, the group spearheading the BDS referendum at UBC.
So what position are you coming from on this issue? What created your position?
In terms of Palestine specifically, like throughout junior high, high school, I had like a vague understanding of it, or we were never taught that much about it. But I always noted, especially in 2008, 2009, when a lot of horrible attacks were happening, that there was kind of a disparity between the two sides. And then again, late high school, early university, I started reading up the history of the occupation. And I'm like, this is horrible and very new as well. It's been a 60-year struggle. But in my first year of university, I was not part of SPHR. Friends of mine were, but I was not. Then Operation Protective Edge in the summer happened, where 2,000 plus Palestinians were killed. And that just emotionally destroyed me. I could not comprehend that. And I was like, I have to do something about this. So I joined SPHR. The reason I care about Palestine, even though I'm not Palestinian, is just that it blows my mind that this is happening in our day and age. And a lot of people don't talk about it, or they often demonize Palestinians. It's a moral obligation, basically, especially for me, coming from a place that has been formerly colonized. And I've seen in Pakistan the very violent results of that. So,
yeah. So why do you believe BDS is beneficial to UBC students? Jewish, Palestinian, neither?
Okay, so in general, I think that BDS, because it's so kind of galvanizing, it's a good place to start the conversation. BDS has been going on for about 10 years, and it's arguably the largest and most successful, like, peaceful resistance to what Israel has been doing. And because it's so successful and so many people know about it, maybe not UBC, but all over the world, it's like a good kind of talking point instead of just being like, oh, let's go into the history of Palestine, because people might not be educated about that. It's like just a starting point. And then because of its controversial nature, people start asking questions and debating. So UBC students from all over the spectrum, it's a good place to start. And it's also just been an effective, peaceful measure of resistance, which is always good to promote as opposed to alternatives. And also I think that we should have accountability. Historically, you know, UBC students opposed the Vietnam War. It took us a while, but we did take a stance on South African apartheid. The referendum failed the first time. It's a question of legacy. I think it's why it's beneficial to all students, is that they can look back and be like, I wasn't a bystander. I didn't facilitate oppression. I took a stance against it. I tried to help fight against it. and just because of how big it is and the fact that BDS itself was called upon by Palestinians for Palestinian students here and abroad, the fact that UBC would enact BDS would, I think, be powerful in terms of solidarity. In terms of Jewish students on campus, the way that we've worded the referendum, I hope, does not alienate any student. We don't kind of make any reference to any ethnicity or religion. It's the fact that the state of Israel is facilitating it, not the Jewish people themselves, who are not even all represented by the state of Israel. We have organizations like Independent Jewish Voices in Vancouver, which support BDS. We have Jewish students in SPHR. And so I'd like to think it's not an alienating issue towards that, because a state does not represent the people. Like, I'm a Canadian, and I don't think that the Harper government accurately represents my interests in terms of, like, you know, missing and murdered Indigenous women or the environment. It's the fact that this is a state, this is a government, a formal entity that is complicit in very horrible things, and there should be pressure against it, like any state, not against the people. So that's how I think it would affect all these different facets of the campus.
So do you believe open dialogue between the two sides is possible?
Dialogue is possible. It's just that we have to be careful about how that dialogue is conducted. One of the things is that I feel that we need to recognize what's happening, and the dialogue cannot whitewash what is happening in the occupied territories within the state of Israel as well. For that to happen, there has to be some sort of, I think, moral responsibility, or at least condemnation. So if the opposition explicitly recognizes that, okay, this is horrible, we condemn this, we do recognize there's occupation, that there's apartheid, that this is a colonial state, if there's that kind of foundation of bearing witness to truth, then I think definitely, yes, it's more than possible. And I think there is a willingness now on both sides to talk. It's just that we don't want to normalize the occupation and discuss it as if it's just another, you know, conflict in the world that has specific causes and specific roots that we don't want to paint over. And by doing so, doing a disservice to the Palestinian people and their oppression. We should also be clear of dialogue towards what ends. Like, are we having a dialogue to understand each other? Are we having dialogue to form some sort of plan, some sort of form of solidarity? So dialogue for the sake of dialogue, I think, would almost be a waste of time. It's just like idle chit-chat, right? And I think the way the dialogue is framed is also important. So we talked about whitewashing, we talked about dialogue towards what ends, but or dialogue can have inbuilt questions or presumptions into them. If me and you talked about right now, it's like, oh, let's discuss why radio is dead, which it is not. But if we had something, if we had to do some ludicrous conversation like that, it has a built-in presumption instead of talking about, like, oh, let's discuss the value of radio, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think if there was that kind of common base of respect and recognition for what's going on and not whitewashing the issue, I think if we were clear towards why we're doing this dialogue, and I think if it was framed in the right way, but rather in a way that's conductive and not just obfuscating, then definitely there's a possibility for dialogue. If we come out from that place of respect and there's that sincere outreach, then in the future, yeah, for sure.
What are your long-term hopes for the referendum on UBC beyond the yes or no decision?
People don't talk about Palestine, full stop. It is very controversial, as any social issue has been controversial. But in the long run, you know, justice does kind of win out, and then people are left, hopefully, thinking about their legacies. Every single movement for justice in the world makes people uncomfortable, especially when people are complicit in it, unconsciously or consciously. And so my hope is for people to think about, SPHR's hope rather, is for people to think about their legacies and their complicitness. Because if you take a stance of neutrality because of indifference, because of apathy, not because of genuine, like, you know, formulation of your opinions, but being a bystander is almost the same as being a bully. Either way, you're fueling something that's wrong. So my hope is for people to think about their legacies and their complicitness, and ultimately just to raise questions. And there's been talk about SPHR or the opposition being anti-dialogue or what have you, and I don't think that's true, because what we're doing right now is a form of dialogue. Talking to the UBC, making letters to editors, that's dialogue. Tabling is dialogue. Talking to people in classrooms or just handing out information, collecting signatures, that's all a form of discussion and dialogue. So it's galvanizing, people are talking about it, which is better than not talking about it. So my long-term hope, I think I can speak for all of us, is just to get people thinking. To get people thinking about, what is my place in this? Am I helping? Am I harming? And what is this issue? Why are people talking about it so heatedly?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Next up, we have Sam Heller, a political science major, a Jewish Israeli-Canadian student, and associated with Hillel at UBC, arguing against BDS.
So what's your position on this issue, and where do you get that position from?
I would hope that the campus, like, if, since we are going to a referendum, I would hope that the campus would vote no. And the reason I hope for the campus to vote no is that I really truly believe that this is a much more complicated situation than folks understand. This affects a group of students on campus in an extremely negative way, myself included. And I believe that there are other ways that issues addressed by this referendum could sort of be dealt with or at least discussed. That at the end of the day, a BDS, boycott, divestment, sanction, is basically putting on the books of this campus one side is right and one side is wrong, an extremely, extremely complicated foreign policy issue. I think that I'm coming at this by saying that being anti-BDS is not being anti-Palestinian, but I do believe that being pro-BDS at the end of the day is being anti-Israel and to a certain extent anti-Jewish. And maybe folks could debate that, they could not. I certainly believe that it is to a certain extent.
So how do you believe this referendum is harmful to UBC students, Jewish or otherwise? In what ways?
I mean, the question itself that we're being asked is pretty offensive in my mind. It's an extremely charged question. It seems to me that it's really hard for people to vote no to that. I don't want to vote no. Like, I mean, I see war crimes and I clearly say to myself, how could I, you know, support war crimes? I'm clearly going to vote yes. Of course we should boycott this country. Of course this should happen. But I think that it is really taken out of context, and I think that people need more education about what that really means. Israel's never been convicted of war crimes. There have been accusations that fly around. Israel's probably the most condemned country in the world. In terms of putting this to a referendum, I just believe that it's far more complicated than folks think. Like, you're looking at a question like this, the language and the message behind it, it's rather aggressive, I would say, and it makes me not really feel welcome here. And I think it makes many Jewish students feel unwelcome here. It definitely makes Israeli students feel unwelcome here. And this campus is about unity and it's about dialogue. I think university is a place for dialogue, and I think it's a place for people to get together and to discuss really thorny issues, but to discuss those issues, not to then put the student body to a vote that is then on an issue that they don't understand but is going to seriously affect a group of students on this campus. I just don't see it as being productive, and I don't see it as being in the spirit of what we're here for and in the spirit of even UBC's defined mission.
So do you believe open dialogue between the two sides is possible? If so, how? And if no, why not?
It's an interesting one. I think that pushing for dialogue is always important. I think that it is definitely possible. I think it's more possible on sort of like an individual basis, you know, from person to person, like with whatever side you're on. It comes down to a discussion of narratives. It's like one group's narrative versus another group's narrative, but like there are so many different narratives that are packed into these bigger narratives, and I think people sort of, it's important for people to hear what the other has to say. Whether that truly will change their mind, maybe not, maybe it'll just lead you to be even more supportive of what you actually believe, but I can't think of the last time that there was anything sort of official between two groups here at UBC. I definitely think that when people are tabling, I think it leads to discussion. And I think for the most part, there's been pretty amicable discussion. But at least it creates awareness and people are talking. And I think that's really important. Yes, dialogue is possible. You know, we're programmed to not want to listen to things we don't agree with. And we're programmed to automatically fight against it. But I do think it's important to put yourself through that, however painful it is. And I think that as individuals, we can do that. And that's a start. That's definitely a start.
Yeah. So what are your long-term hopes for this referendum? After the yes or no decision, what are effects that you hope this referendum will have at UBC?
I would definitely say that, like, as a person who wants to be more politically engaged and is trying to be politically engaged, I think it's important for everyone to be politically engaged, and whether it's issues that we... that is more close to home, or whether it's issues that are far away, it's important to sort of understand what's going on, but to like truly understand what's going on and like really look at it critically and look at what's going on, you know, and look at it from different perspectives, because
not just read a BuzzFeed article.
Yeah, like there's always two sides to a story. And I would say that particularly with this issue, I think that folks need to, not need to, hopefully will be more critical about what they're hearing from what everyone's hearing. I think that it's important to realize that there's someone's going to say black, someone's going to say white, and really what it comes down to is gray. Mm-hmm. There's lots of shades of gray. Nobody's perfect. Nobody's right. And I would, you know, I would hope that, that people would really go and take a and dig into the nitty gritty of this. I consider myself to be pro-Palestinian, and I'm pro-Israel. They are not mutually exclusive. And so I think it's important for folks to understand that, that those aren't mutually exclusive positions. I want people to talk about this issue. It's kind of where I'm getting, you know, what I'm trying to get at. Like, I want people to really feel that they can sit and discuss it. Have, you know, lectures and, you know, professors coming in and, you know, a panel of speakers. When I think about UBC and I think about sort of being, you know, in Canada, and what we should be about here, we should be about finding a solution. So let's find a solution, or let's support groups that want to find a solution. Why don't we pass a resolution in council or as a community that, you know, we want to support groups that are looking for peaceful coexistence and dialogue amongst Israelis and Palestinians over there. Like, I mean, people are talking there. We're not talking here for some unknown reason. In terms of after, I hope political, and you know, people are more politically engaged, people are understanding more so what is going on in that part of the world, and I hope that sort of something good comes from that. Maybe we will be able to create some joint fund that, you know, puts money towards coexistence movements and social justice movements, but, you know, in both places. Maybe we should be working on, I don't know, helping Palestinians develop their infrastructure, or, you know, help movements like what's, it's called like the One Voice movement, which is pushing for a two-state solution, and it's active in Palestine, and it's active in Israel, and it's, you know, trying to get people together to sort of like join in that vision. I want to see a two-state solution. I don't think that's so much to ask. BDS and the movement itself is calling for essentially no Israel, and I can't get behind that.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Third is Eviatar Bach, a physics major, Canadian-Israeli, and co-chair of the Social Justice Club on campus, in favor of BDS.
So what position are you coming from on the issue of BDS?
So I'm in favor of the referendum. I was born in Israel. I lived there for 8 years. I mean, I have a lot of family there. I think the claims that anyone who is in favor of boycotting certain Israeli companies, that makes you against Israel or anti-Semitic, I think, well, it doesn't make sense. And if that were the case, then
you wouldn't be.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have the position that you have now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very, I mean, like, there's so many people in Israel who are really critical of what the government is doing. They've been critical of the occupation and a lot of these things. I mean, we just found out that Netanyahu won the elections, and it's becoming a very scary place to live, even for Jews, and let alone Palestinians. It's very right-wing, militaristic. There's very virulent racism all across the country, discrimination, and it's very widespread. So the hope is that ending the occupation would make life better for Palestinians and for Jews in Israel-Palestine.
So how do you think that the referendum is beneficial or harmful to UBC students on campus, Jewish or Palestinian or neither?
Well, I don't think that it really affects Jewish students in any way. I mean, obviously a lot of Jewish students care about the outcome of the referendum, and not all of them are siding with what Hillel is doing. Hillel doesn't represent all Jews on campus. But really, I think the point is that it's the student society, and students can express their collective opinions on issues and take actions on those opinions. And that includes boycotting certain companies. I think it's perfectly valid. I think for Palestinian students, not to have to be faced with products that are oppressing, or products from companies that are oppressing their people, I think that's important. And I think it's really important to just take a moral stance on this issue. I think a few decades from now, people will be looking back and saying, oh, why didn't we do anything about this? Why didn't we take a stance? And I think if you look back at what happened in 1987, there was a referendum to boycott companies involved in the apartheid, in the South African apartheid regime at UBC, and it didn't pass. And I mean, I think we look at that now and say, why didn't students pass it? It should have been passed. I think we have, obviously not the same situation now, but analogous in some respect.
So do you believe open dialogue between the yes side and the no side is possible? And if not, why not? And if so, how so?
Well, first of all, I would have to be informed of what the purpose of that dialogue would be. I think a lot of the way like these dialogue initiatives are posed are between interactions between Jewish and Muslim students, and I think that's great, but I don't think that's, if we want to talk about the issues. And I think it dialogue initiatives have to be more explicit about what they want. Like the open dialogue campaign was very vague and didn't say what it was about.
The Open Dialogue campaign by
the Open Dialogue UBC that was started by the Jewish Student Association didn't say what it was about, what its goals were or anything. It was just making vague allusions to things. And I think what I've heard from other students in SBHR is that dialogue should also be predicated upon some common understandings of, for example, the power imbalance in the conflict and things like that.
What do you hope the long-term results of the referendum will be on the UBC campus past the yes or no decision?
I think it's valuable as an educational tool. I think this issue wouldn't be as prominent on the campus now if the referendum hadn't been proposed. So it's an educational tool. Universities and students are often at the forefront of a lot of social justice issues. So in bringing this to the student body, getting people to talk about the issue, or to think about the issue, and if it passes, I think that would send a strong message, and it would be one step towards achieving peace and justice in Israel-Palestine.
Thank you very much. And finally, I talked to Leo Rabinovich, a mechanical engineering student and a member of the Jewish Students Association against BDS. So what position are you coming from on the issue of BDS?
So I grew up, I'm Jewish. I grew up in a very progressive Zionist background. I'm very Zionist, but I also really believe in social justice in Israel. And that would make it seem like I would support BDS. But I don't believe BDS is actually helping Palestinians because of many things. The larger aims of the movement are anti-Israel in essence. And many Palestinians have also said it's not that beneficial for their movement. I believe in a Palestinian state. I believe in social justice for Palestinians in Israel, but I also believe in a Jewish state, very two-state oriented. But I don't believe BDS is a very effective method of getting towards two states or actually making real change on the ground in Israel.
So why do you believe BDS is harmful to UBC students, Jewish or non-Jewish?
So it's tough because Jews and Palestinians on campus both have extreme emotional attachment to this issue. And BDS kind of makes it yes, no, yes, I support Palestinian causes, no, I don't support Palestinian causes, or yes, I support Israel, no, I don't support Israel, depending on where you're coming from. So that can be very personally harmful for individuals and polarizing. But what I hope BDS does is actually brings people together, creates dialogue. In its essence, it doesn't really do that because of its polarizing nature, but I would like this issue on campus to create more individuals with more nuanced views on the topic and more commitment towards social justice.
So do you believe open dialogue between the two sides is possible?
It's tough. It's possible, but it's maybe not the most effective thing. I as someone who's Jewish and believe in both a Jewish state and a Palestinian state, could approach Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, and I could say, I believe in your cause, and I recognize my my privilege and power as a Jew in this context. But in the end, that's really it. I can just say we agree. I hope we agree. And that's the end of dialogue, you know? That's important. It's important to understand where each other are coming from, but it's not going to make the real change on the ground. Hopefully, campus will create the kind of individuals who go out into the world and make that change. And that starts through dialogue on campus, but that's kind of the end of dialogue.
So what do you hope the end result of the referendum to be? Like, regardless of the result, what do you hope that it will accomplish?
Even though it is such a polarized topic and its nature is essentially polarizing, I want BDS to strengthen Jewish and Palestinian communities on campus, educate more people on this topic, those who have personal investment and those who just are interested in international relations. And again, in the end, results in more individuals who are more invested in social justice in Israel and Palestine.
Thank you very much. Even the language I used in the introduction to this piece, against Israel, occupation, Palestinian origin, are in dispute. Everything about this question and this issue is in dispute. In fact, the only thing that is not contested is that it's affecting people. It affects individuals on our campus and outside of our campus. So before, or if, you cast a vote in the BDS referendum coming to UBC next week, think about what you're doing. Make an informed decision. It's the one thing that everyone I talked to had in common. Whether they wanted the referendum to occur or not, on both sides of the issue, people hope that this referendum will raise awareness and encourage political engagement. Let's at least give them that.
Thank you to Moira and everyone who participated in her interviews. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Has mental illness or addiction touched your life? You might be interested in coming out to the Kaleidoscope, UBC's first and only student-created, peer-run mental health support group at the university's Vancouver campus. They offer a stigma-free place for people to share their stories with others going through similar experiences. The Kaleidoscope meets every week on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Center for Student Involvement in Brock Hall.
Learn more at the-kaleidoscope.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have Rohit Joseph's interviews with Jordan Bateman and Gordon Price, who represent the no and yes sides, respectively, in the transit referendum.
Hello there, listeners. This is Rohit Joseph, one of the senior producers here at News 101. In the past few weeks, the biggest political issue that has firmly occupied my mind has been the transit referendum. For those of you who have somehow managed to avoid the avalanche of coverage, I will try to provide a brief breakdown of the transit referendum. The transit referendum, as it is commonly known, seeks the general public's decision on the transportation funding measures identified by the Metro Vancouver Mayor's Council. The referendum takes the form of a mail-in ballot. The question posed on this mail-in ballot is as follows. Do you support a 1/2 percentage point increase to the provincial sales tax in Metro Vancouver, dedicated to the mayor's transportation and transit plan with independent audits and public reporting? This seemingly innocuous question has spawned polarizing debate with passionate voices on the yes and no sides. This week, I spoke with prominent representatives from the yes and no sides, respectively. From the no camp, there is Jordan Bateman, the BC director for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation and a former township councillor for the city of Langley. Jordan Bateman has become the leading voice for the no side as a result of his emphatic anti-TransLink rhetoric. Jordan strongly advocates for the reform of TransLink's governance model, as well as alternative methods of funding public transportation that are not reliant on taxpayers. On the yes side, I interviewed Gordon Price, director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University. Gordon Price is a firm believer in the material as well as cultural benefits of expanding our public transportation network. According to Price, the stakes are extremely high with this referendum.
which is why he believes a no vote could prove damaging to the city for decades to come. When I conducted these interviews, I had no intention of having an intensive debate with either Jordan or Gordon. Instead, I opted to listen to their arguments and give them the opportunity to speak directly to one of CITR's key demographics, the UBC students. Without further ado, here are the interviews. So first things first, Jordan, for those listeners who may not be familiar with TransLink and how it operates as a government-backed corporation, what can you tell us?
Well, TransLink is a company created by provincial law. So under provincial law, they're the only people who can provide transit services in the Lower Mainland. They're a $1.4 billion a year company now with about $850 million of that coming through taxes and the rest through tolls, advertising, and other income streams. They've been around basically for 15 or 16 years, have had three or four different governance models, none of which seem to have solved the core problems within TransLink, which is a wasteful culture that puts personal agendas ahead of the public good and, frankly, focuses too much on things that don't move a single person a single inch. So now there's, there's actually six boards of directors at TransLink now. It's a big conglomeration of other smaller shell companies, which it completely owns. There's a mayor's council that offers input on some funding decisions and, votes on appointments to the board. And then there's also the Minister of Transportation who, as steward of the legislation, also has responsibility for it. So it's one of those companies where everyone is in charge and yet no one seems to be in charge, which is probably one of their biggest problems.
Maybe we could get specifically into the problems that you see with how TransLink operates.
Well, the first big problem is secrecy. TransLink has six boards of directors, none of whom meet in public. So they make billion-dollar decisions with taxpayer money, but aren't accountable to the public for how they're making those decisions. So, they roll out these plans, and the public are often gobsmacked by what's going on, and sometimes even the mayors. Some of the most vociferous critics of TransLink over the years have been the mayors themselves. TransLink is an incredibly wasteful organization. Take your pick of stories. We're actually putting one a day on our notranslinktax.ca website. We have more than 90 waste stories about TransLink that we found in recent years or the media have uncovered or whistleblowers have led us to. So,
is there a particular one that you think is a prime example of the wastefulness?
Yeah, once they get a lot of attention, CEOs spending more on our CEO than Chicago or LA or New York City spends on their transit CEO. The Compass Card fiasco is now years late and, about $30 million over budget and probably a lot more than that once we get all the facts. The leased empty buildings for $1.8 million. It's just a long laundry list and people who want to see it should go to notranslinktax.ca and see all the different ways that they've bungled their spending.
So what is your stance on the proposed extension of the SkyTrain system in Broadway to extend to Arbutus?
Well, Arbutus, it's really a subway to nowhere. And, for UBC students, I'm not sure much will change. You'll get to Arbutus and you'll have to climb up the stairs and get on a Beeline bus for the last, 7 or 8 kilometers to the school. So they're spending a bunch of money to put it underground. They're using the most expensive transit technology they can find, and that's really limiting the usefulness of it. I also have a problem with the way the mayor of Vancouver has approached this issue. In Surrey, you have a mayor who says whether the tax is approved or not, she'll find a plan B. She actually already has a plan B to fund light rail in her city. Patello Toll Bridge doesn't even need to be in this plan. It's a toll bridge and would be financed by tolls, so it will go forward no matter what. So two of the big three infrastructure projects would happen without the tax. The only person who doesn't seem to have a backup plan for their pet project is Gregor Robertson, and the guy's had 10 years in power, and I think that's more a failure of his leadership than a failure of regional taxpayers in not paying enough money.
As it stands right now, do you believe that the suburbs of Vancouver are lacking adequate access to public transportation?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are many suburbs, and even in the mayor's plan, folks saying, look, again, most of this money is, you know, funding things in Vancouver and not funding other things around the region. The North Shore isn't happy with this plan because there's virtually nothing for them there. Delta isn't happy with the plan. Maple Ridge, Langley. There's a real treatment here where it TransLinks operated under this fallacy that, you know, moving people around the region means moving them to the downtown. That really isn't the case anymore. You know, they're trying to build, you know, put more jobs out in various communities, and instead of serving them, they're trying to funnel us all into downtown Vancouver, where, bluntly, the mayor of Vancouver really doesn't want us anyways.
What would be the alternative methods of funding of these TransLink projects instead of the tax funding model that's proposed by the referendum?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different options that have been floated. Like I said, the mayor of Surrey has a plan B for Surrey Light Rail.
Yeah.
Patel is a toll bridge. The mayors could have funded their entire plan simply by earmarking 0.5% of future revenue growth towards it. So every year for the past 10 years, local government in the Lower Mainland has seen an average revenue growth of 6%. Even during the economic downturn in 2008, they still got more money. So, you know, going forward, you know, if we projected that out at, you know, a more modest 4.8% annual growth rate, all they would have to do is allocate 0.5% of that to this plan. They could fund the whole thing. So this tax is really unnecessary. The mayors would still have, you know, more than 4% growth every single year to spend on the other priorities that they think are important in their communities. But you'd be funding it out of local government revenue growth instead of coming back to taxpayers for more money and for a brand new tax.
Is there a reason they'd be very reluctant to use the funds from the revenues? I mean, it would seem harder to try and convince taxpayers to pay more taxes.
The mayor is locked in that they needed more money. And, you know, across the country, there's been a push by cities to get a hold of sales taxes for a long time. It's an ideological push. They desperately want into sales taxes. And no province, no federal government has ever given them access to it. So they see this as a chance to tilt that scale and get a hold of a tax they've never gotten a hold of before. That's actually one of the things that concerns me most is, you know, TransLink and the cities have a bad record when it comes to taxes. They constantly raise them, and they raise them faster than any other level of government. You know, a gas tax for TransLink that used to be 4 cents a liter is now 22. A parking tax that was 7% for TransLink is now 21%. You know, a property tax that was $50 a house is now $250. So, you know, you give them a 0.5% sales tax increase. Their own plan shows they're about $150 million short a year by year 10, even with the tax. You know, they're going to come in and demand even more money. So, you know, this is a tax that will go on forever. Students will pay it the longest because, you know, you're going to live longer than the rest of us. This is going to be a very expensive fix for something that we didn't need to do that we could have funded through growth.
Speaking of students, students and members probably of the working class tend to use TransLink and transit public transportation quite a lot. What do you think are the biggest incentives for these groups in particular to vote no? You've mentioned some of them, but maybe if there are additional ones that you think are also important to keep in mind.
Well, we need to remember that, you know, being a student is a relatively short-term part of your life. You know, for me, it was a couple years at Langara, and then I've just finished my master's at Royal Roads, a couple years there. Even for people who are in school the longest, you know, you're talking about less than, you know, often 10% of their lives. You're going to pay this tax forever. Long after you've stopped using the B line, long after the Arbutus subway, you know, is built or whatever, you are going to be paying for it over and over and over and over and over and over again. Billions and billions of dollars coming out of your pockets over the next, you know, 80 years. TransLink also has a bad record, as I said, and is very likely to increase this tax. Past behavior being a good predictor of future behavior, that's just what they do. I'm also concerned in the short term about how it affects the retail sector. I know many students, not all students, but many students have second jobs, usually in, you know, retail or something like that, to kind of help with school costs. This tax hits the retail sector very hard. It's why the Retail Council opposes it. It's why the Canadian Federation of Independent Business opposes it. I worry about, you know, what the unexpected outcome as far as jobs and able to compete with people outside the region go for those smaller businesses.
In spite of being against TransLink, do you see yourself as a proponent for expanding public transit and transportation?
Yeah, you know, I was a two-term township councillor here in Langley, and I've always fought for more transit. The problem is TransLink has broken trust with the public. You know, if they didn't waste all this money, the transit system would be a lot further along. Would it be perfect? No, probably not. But, you know, there would definitely be improvements, things that tangible things we could point to that were better. Instead, you know, they got lost in their own political agendas and finding ways to line their own pockets and reward their own consultants and buddies instead of actually doing what was right for, you know, the public at large. So, you know, if you want to improve transit, as I do, you've got to get TransLink running more efficiently because, again, by law, they're the only operation that's allowed to do it.
Is there any, perhaps, like a role model that you've seen in maybe another city that your organization has researched about? Is there some kind of ideal way that we can do this that has been proven in another major city?
You know, Hong Kong gets floated around a lot, and I think part of the conversation after the vote has to be, you know, what are the best performing, best performing transit systems in the world, and what can we learn from them? TransLink consultants and supporters are always so haughty about TransLink. You know, they can do no wrong, and you know, everyone else should learn from TransLink. But it's pretty clear that TransLink has lost public confidence, and we need to go and find places. There has to be somewhere in the world that's running a transit system efficiently and effectively that we can take a look at and learn from.
That's actually all the questions I have for you, Jordan. Thank you so much for taking the time. Take care.
My name is Gordon Price. I'm director of the SFU City Program.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with how TransLink works, could you explain how TransLink functions as a government-backed corporation?
Right. It's effectively a provincial agency. The legislation comes from the province. It's responsible for one region. It's one of the largest transit areas in North America. It provides many different choices of transportation. Also has a responsibility for some roads and bridges. It operates with one fare medium. That is something we take for granted, but is actually fairly unusual in most urban regions where one ticket will get you almost all places on almost all of the different forms of transportation that TransLink is responsible for. And it has basically a complex governance system. That seems to be the focus of a lot of attention. Originally, it was directors that were appointed by the Metro Board of the Greater Vancouver Regional District. Now, more complex.
What are some of the specific projects that the proposed tax-based funding would be put towards?
Well, the ones that are probably most interest to students, of course, is the Broadway line that would at least get you to Arbutus and then rapid bus and eventually a streetcar and maybe eventually a tunnel to UBC.
That would definitely be of interest for UBC students.
Yeah, that would be helpful. It'll take a few years, but at least it's part of the plan. And critically, you know, you have to think about transportation as being part of a network. It's just not a question of one rail line and the right-of-way that it has. It's what it connects to. And when you think about the importance of having some relief from, say, Commercial and Broadway, particularly when the Evergreen Line is open, how important it is for the line to be extended past Vancouver Community College to the Canada Line, eventually to serve the second biggest downtown in British Columbia, all along Broadway, the hospital complex, eventually connecting UBC and in turn along the Expo Line to Simon Fraser out in Surrey, to what they call Innovation Boulevard and the research opportunities that will be there. Whether you're a student or someone who works there or a resident anywhere in the region, really, you have to be part of a frequent transit network. And when you look at all the other pieces of the plan, the 11B lines, the night buses, the additional frequent service, the 400 new buses, the C bus providing 10-minute service, all of these new options integrated into one large network with a multitude of choices, with a single fare, that is an extraordinary achievement, and it's reflected in the very high ridership that we have in this region. We have, after New York and Toronto, the highest ridership per capita in North America. For a city of our size, we have one of the best systems, I would say, overall, because it does offer so many choices. It is as frequent as it is. Remarkably, SkyTrain has measured its frequency in seconds, not in minutes. And it has the potential to be much better because we've got a good foundation to build from.
Just to follow up, actually, on some of the projects, there have been claims from the No camp that Linda Heppner, the mayor of Surrey, would be going ahead with the light rail project in Surrey, regardless of a no vote. And as well, they also there's also been reference to the Patullo Bridge, and whether that would actually be from tax-based funding or road usage. Could you comment on these two particular projects?
What are they connected to? It's as though, again, that you build a single project in isolation without thinking about how it's connected to the rest of the system. Even if Surrey was able to find the money within Surrey to build light rail, what happens when you get outside of Surrey? Who will be operating the line within Surrey? Does Surrey think, for instance, that TransLink will take on the cost with no new source of revenue to operate light rail, take the service away from someone else? This is the danger, that if things are done in isolation, it would tend to rip the region apart, as one part of the region has to suffer in order for another part to benefit. Better with this plan, where there is at least something for everyone, but more importantly, it is part of a larger network. It's part of the region. It makes us a region. To be taking little pieces of it, even if they're big, expensive pieces, and think that they can be done in isolation without imagining what the future for the region is overall, for decades down the road, for how we build as much as how we move. That's really the danger here, of thinking something can be done on the cheap, or that someone else will have to pay, or that only one part of it should be done. It's not the kind of thinking that made this region so successful. And it's not really the kind of future that when people talk about it, it's not what they're thinking. They still think, oh yeah, we can find other ways to do it, or at least hope that someone else will pay. The cost that they're looking at of about 35 cents a day when you work it out is actually a pretty good deal, very good deal, in fact, when you consider the alternative, which would be to be relying on roads and bridges in the absence of transit, never keep up, and not the quality of life that we want. So it is a yes or no that isn't just about transit. It's not just TransLink. It's not even this moment in time. It's what we are going to build for at least a generation. None of this can be done in isolation of time. None of it can be done in isolation of one part of the region or the other. And that's the kind of thinking that this region really needs to be successful, and why a no vote, I think, would be so destructive, not just because we would lose out, have to spend more to do less, but that we would lose that sense of vision, that sense of who we are and what we can be.
To what extent do you agree with these claims that TransLink is wasteful or inept?
So am I. And so are you.
Yeah, we are all human, yes.
Well, and we would maybe make different decisions. Do we waste money? Well, yeah, you know, that's the nature of the human experience. It's not to excuse it. But when you do get the kind of incessant criticism, the vilification, where trivia is used as something to justify, I hear people saying the whole organization should be dismantled. What do they mean? What do they mean? That we should chop it up? Each piece being operated separately by separate municipalities, parts of it privatized, that you would no longer have a single fare medium, you wouldn't be operating within a single transit area. I don't think they mean that. But do they mean another set of politicians? Do they mean a separately elected board? People don't go that far.
Apparently, accountability or transparency were two things that get brought up. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, don't we all?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what you're voting for. And no vote is, I'm not going to vote to spend money to build a better region that's shaped around transit. And you don't get to go back the next day and say, well, I didn't really mean that. I was just sending a message to TransLink. I still want that transit. But that's not what you voted for. You voted no. And it's going to take a minimum of 3 years before we even get to ask the question again. We would lose a decade. Assuming it passed, we might lose a generation, but you don't get to stop making decisions about how you're going to build the region. Development still has to go ahead. People still have to get to university. Decisions have to be made, and if you haven't got the transit or don't think you will, well, do you drive? Do you spend maybe $10,000 a year rather than $135 a year for that second car, for the first car? Do you have to then compete with everybody else who has to make the same decision, breathe that same air? Realize that, maybe transit would have been a better choice, but because we don't have it, we're kind of stuck. I don't think that's the choice that people believe they would be making by voting no, but that may well be the reality.
And how about for not only students, but members of the working class? Do you think that the PST has a risk of disproportionately affecting the increase in PST, that is, has a risk of disproportionately affecting poorer populations? Or are there ways to mitigate this that the mayor and the city council are going to implement?
Well, for three things. One, truly poor people who don't really have the option even to buy a car. For them, transit is a life necessity. So it's true, they will be spending more, but they are going to get a disproportionate benefit as well. Secondly, things like food are not taxed. So for them, a lot of the necessities, they're not going to be affected by it. Thirdly, there are ways of, as we do with the carbon tax, of getting a PST credit. If that's the concern, that can be addressed. But for most, certainly poor people, and for low-income working people, the return that they get from having a transit system that works for them so that they can get to work and back, so that they have some choices, mm-hmm. this is one of the best deals that they can get for the amount of money that they would have to spend or not have to spend because they didn't have the choice. Maybe weren't able to get a job because they couldn't get to work. I mean, there are a lot more expensive things that can occur because you don't have a transit system that works for you.
Globally speaking, are there cities that Vancouver can look to for inspiration in this pursuit of expanding our public transportation? And did these cities go about achieving their funding through a similar kind of referendum or through other methods, perhaps?
You're asking more than I know. Yes, there's always other places we can look to. Certainly European examples, Zurich is often pointed to, but there are cities of a similar size around North America, mm-hmm. and it really is hard to find anyone that is as good. They come here to see what we've got, and that includes looking at organizations like TransLink, because at least its original legislation is something many jurisdictions envy. Single agency responsible for multiple forms of transportation with a variety of funding sources have to be matched up and consistent with the regional plan. Working together across the region, mayors and councillors involved in this have to be consistent with the local plans. This is all good stuff. And you can see it's reflected in the ridership and the quality of the transit system. Don't know too many people, yes, the system can always be better, but given its constraints, it's pretty good. It's gotten a lot better in about the last 15 years. There was a major expansion that occurred in the 2000s. And when we look at the Olympics, which people seem to have forgotten, the system performed so well that there was never really a story other than, you know, a few lost bus drivers. But more than anything else, it provided such a high level of service that the following year after the Olympics, it even increased its ridership. Kind of forgotten that. That's so amazing. That
Definitely. I've benefited from the Canada Line.
Oh, and not just the Canada Line. All of the express services, the experience that people got, the fact that the ridership actually did increase that following February after the Olympics. I mean, no one expected that because people understood that the system really did work. If they had maybe experienced it for the first time getting to the games, they realized it was a practical alternative for some things. Not for all things, not for all the time. No system of transportation works that way. It would be as wrong to think that everyone can get around by bicycle as it is to think they could all get around by transit or all get around by car. You've got to have the mix. And if we don't have the transit and people have to fall back on the automobile, in a limited amount of road space, unless they're prepared to spend 3, 4, 5 times as much on what this proposal would cost them, we're not going to have a road system that can meet our demands either. Another million people, next 30 years, that's just extrapolating past growth. It probably is conservative, if anything. 600,000 vehicles that would come onto the road, that would be a lineup that would stretch across Canada, a good part of Canada. I mean, it's very difficult to get a sense of the scale of what we're dealing with when you're talking about growth in a region like ours that's so constrained by its environment. The cost is going to be high regardless of the choice, but when you compare it to the alternatives, the mayor's package looks pretty good. It offers people something around the region as, again, part of this integrated system. Got to really emphasize how important it is to have an integrated, seamless transportation system that gives people the choices that they can make for how they get around to meet their various needs. Transit's just a part of it, but it's an essential part if the other parts are going to work.
Well, thank you so much, Gordon. You've given some really thoughtful and very detailed responses. Thank you for spending your time with us here on CITR 101.9, News 101. We thank you very much.
Well, for students in particular, it's critical that you vote.
Yes.
You're considered to be a key constituency here. So if you are registered or can still get registered and have that envelope in front of you, you know what to do.
Absolutely, Gordon. Thank you so much. And
thanks, Arif.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Jordan Bateman and Gordon Price for taking the time to speak with News 101. Voting is open till May 29th, which is ample time for all Vancouverites to weigh the options and educate themselves on the referendum's issues. Here at News 101, we will be providing ongoing coverage of the transit referendum. Please do your part and make sure you fill in your mail-in ballot and place your vote. It is imperative that our voices, particularly the voices of university students, are heard on the transit referendum. If you haven't done so already, you can register to vote at www.elections.bc.ca.
Thank you, Rohit.
And that's our program for today, March 20th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Emily Blake. Today's broadcast was produced by Marco Perdonovich. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM. To close off the show, we have number 17 on this week's charts. This is Earth E off the album with the same name by The Satisfaction.